Thank you. Okay, it's a great pleasure to be here tonight in Brooklyn. For some reason, when I speak a lot in different parts of America, I don't speak so much in Brooklyn. Don't know why. But I'd like to thank all the people who were involved in making this evening possible. Schoenfeld, etc., etc. So the topic is the animal kingdom in Jewish thought. Now, it's a topic which I've been fascinated in. My whole life I've been fascinated by animals. My parents took me to the zoo when I was 5, picked me up when I was 12, and ever since then I've had a deep interest in the animal kingdom. When I was a kid, I said, you know, when I grow up, people say, what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, I want to have a zoo. And everyone laughed at me because, you know, it's not a job for a nice Jewish boy. They said I should become a computer programmer. Fine. And then after high school, I went to yeshiva and I decided I wanted to become a rabbi. And no, definitely not a job for a nice Jewish boy. But I decided to start looking into the interplay between the two, between Torah and the animal kingdom. And I found a wealth of material. Started running education programs at the Gan HaTorah Tanachi, the Biblical Zoo in Yerushalayim, leading Torah tours of zoos in America, writing some books on these themes. And then gradually over the years, I realized that there were two things that first of all, I wanted to do a really comprehensive book on every single aspect of the animal kingdom in Jewish thought, and that's the Torah Encyclopedia of the Animal Kingdom that just came out. And also, I decided I wanted to make an institution that would be just focused on this point, focused on the animal kingdom in the Torah. So this year, I opened the Biblical Museum of Natural History in Beit Shemesh. So what I'd like to do tonight is speak about this, the concepts involved in this. What does it mean, the animals in Torah? So about 16 years ago, the Biblical Zoo, I said to the Biblical Zoo, I said, look, you know, you call the Biblical Zoo, but there's not really very much biblical about it. Let me write a guidebook for you about animals and Torah. So they said, fine. So I put something together based on, at that time, 16 years ago, what my grasp of the topic was. And it was basically about machshava. It was like different how animals embody different character traits and what we learn from them and so on. And I gave this this manuscript to the zoo. And they read it and they're like, what's this? I said, you know, I mean, this is a guidebook about animals in the Torah. And they said, this is not a book about animals in the Torah. No, you got a book about animals in the Torah. It's what animals are mentioned in the Torah, which animals used to live in Israel, and therefore they're in Tanakh, and they don't live here now, and so on. So who was right? So we're both right. It was different aspects. You see, when we talk about animals in Torah, it encompasses many different areas. One is identifying the animals of the Torah. What are they? One is, that includes also understanding which animals used to live in Eretz Yisrael. It includes what animals, what they signify, why they mentioned in Tanakh. You know, there's just only a minority of occasions where animals are mentioned because they were involved in a story. Most times animals are mentioned in Tanakh, it's to convey an idea because they symbolize something, to convey concepts. It includes looking at our relationship with animals in Halacha and Hashkafa too. It encompasses many, many different areas. So I'd like to give you a taste of some of these areas. One of the first things we have to think about is how are we even like presenting this topic? There's multiple ways of approaching the whole topic. For example, in the museum in Beit Shemesh, we approach it thematically, which means that we have an area devoted to the idea of drawing inspiration from the beauty of the natural world, Niflaa Sabaoi, which is an important aspect. Very often animals are presented in Tanakh as something to marvel at, to draw inspiration from. Then there's Kashrus Simoni Tara, identifying the animals, understanding the Kashrus Shemona Shiratzim. What are the Shemona Shiratzim? So there's different. So that's one way of approaching it thematically. Another way of approaching it is by each individual animal. So that's an approach I did in the encyclopedia. Now, when I was working on the encyclopedia, often I tell people I was working on, they'd say to me, what letter are you up to? And the truth is, that's a very curious question. I'll tell you why. Why would a book, an encyclopedia, be organized alphabetically? There's only two reasons for organizing a book alphabetically. One is because there's just simply no other way of organizing it, like the Encyclopedia Britannica, right? Or the Encyclopedia Talmudis, right? So, you know, it's covering such a diverse range of topics that there's no way of structuring it, so the only way to do it is alphabetically. And the other reason for ordering a book alphabetically is to make it easier to find things. But for that, you don't really need to do that because you have an index, you have a table of contents. So the other way to organize an encyclopedia, if it's not alphabetically, it's conceptually. And so that's the so because that's the approach obviously I wanted to pick here. So if we're ordering the animal kingdom and we're dividing it into different parts and different volumes, because there's much too much to do in just one volume. So what are the ways of splitting up the animal kingdom? So in modern science, it would be you'd have mammals, you'd have birds, reptiles, amphibians, fishes, and vertebrates, insects, right? But that is not the way that the Torah divides animals. Right, how does the Torah divide animals? So we have, what are the categories of animals in the Torah?
Kosher.
So that's one way to divide it. Okay, you could divide it kosher and non-kosher, but that's important for the halachas of kashrus, but beyond that, no, it's not. Behema, chaya, oaf, right, sharets and so on, right?
Large,
right.
Small,
right. Now, right, so there's lots of different ways of dividing it. Now, so that way of dividing it, behema, chaya, oaf, and so on, so it's not a scientific form of classification, right? Because, for example, you have a Mishnah in Kilayin that discusses views that the wolf is a chaya, and according to one view, but the dog is a behena. Right now, scientifically, you know, zoologically, a wolf and a dog are the same thing. Right? A dog is domesticated from a wolf. You can crossbreed dogs and wolves. Right? It's the same thing scientifically. But in the Torah, at least according to one opinion in the Mishnah, one's a chaya, one's a behena. Now, does that mean, do we have here, you know, a conflict between science and Torah? The answer is no. Absolutely not, because it's just a different way of organizing the animals depending on what the purposes are. For example, think about a zoo. How does a zoo organize animals? So, when I was a kid and I went to zoos, the way they would organize them is that they'd have all the carnivores together, and they'd have all the herbivores together, and they'd have all the small animals together in another building, a small animal house, right? And they'd have all, you know, the reptiles in one place. And you can see, if you go to the Bronx Zoo, right, a lot of the older buildings are structured that way. Yeah, the small animal house, the reptile house, things like that. Why do zoos organize animals that way? Because it was very convenient for the zookeepers. Right, so looking after animals, usually all the carnivores need one kind of care and one kind of expertise, and all the reptiles need a different kind of care and expertise, so that's how they organize them. Scientifically, you want to teach different ideas. You want to teach ideas of physiology and so on. Nowadays, zoos organize animals completely differently. They want to teach about ecosystems. So they'll have, you know, the African savanna exhibit. And in the Bronx Zoo, they've got the Congo exhibit, which has got a lot of, you know, they've got snakes, they've got gorillas, they've got all kinds of different things there. What do they all have in common? That they're from the Congo. And they've got the Madagascar exhibit. All right, so there's different ways of organizing the animal kingdom. And it's not that one is right and one is wrong. There's no objective reality to it. Right, it just depends on your purposes. It's like you have an Otsa Sfarim, right? So you can organize the Sfarim differently. You can pull the Halacha Sfarim together, all the Parsha Sfarim together, right? Which personally I think makes most sense. But you'll have other Otsa Sfarim. We'll have, you know, the English Sfarim will all be in one section, right? No matter whether they're Halacha, whether Hashkafa, but they're all in English, so they're all in one section. Right? Not exactly clear on the rationale behind that, but probably an interesting thought. Thing to think about, but you know, there's no right or wrong. It depends on what your priorities and what your goals are. So we don't have here a conflict between science and Torah. It just has different purposes. Right, the Torah is organizing the animal kingdom vis-a-vis man. In other words, science in this way of dividing animals, mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, that's nothing to do with vis-a-vis man. It's the idea of looking at underlying anatomical, physiological patterns in the animal kingdom. Right, but Torah is focused on the animal kingdom as it relates to man. So the differences between a dog and a wolf, right, which are relatively insignificant from a scientific perspective, but from a human perspective, right, they're enormously significant. Right? A dog is man's best friend, and maybe not in Brooklyn, but other parts of the world. And you know, a wolf is a wild animal, a dangerous wild animal. Right? Somebody in Israel just got attacked by a wolf last week. So you know, one's a behemoth, one's a chaya, and that's of overwhelming significance in the Torah way of classifying animals. Right, so here you have an example of how, you know, a different perspective on the animal kingdom, and it's not a conflict with science. It's just has a different operating from within a different framework. And then just to expand on this point further, so let's take the category of oath, right? Let's take a look at birds in the Torah. So the most comprehensive listing of them is in Parshas Shemini, where it has a list of all the treif birds. Right? It starts off with an Esher, ends off with, what's the last one in the list? Atalef. What's an Atalef? A bat. So there's no really. There's, you know, generally, like, universal opinion that Atalef is a bat. Now, is a bat a bird? No, a bat is not a bird. A bat is a mammal. Right? A bird is something with a beak and feathers that lays eggs. Bats do not have beaks, bats do not have feathers, and bats do not lay eggs. So, what's it doing in the list of birds? So this is something that people pose as a question, as a problem. Now, in order to understand the answer, I want to tell you about a court case that took place in New York over 150 years ago. And this court case was about whales. And the issue was taxes. Should the oil from whales have the same fall under the same tax laws as the oil from fish? And the question was, is a whale a fish? So what would you say the answer is a whale a fish? No, a whale is a mammal. Right, fish are cold-blooded, whales are warm-blooded, they give birth to live young, nurse them in milk. Right, so a whale is not a fish. No, the court decided otherwise. The court decided that a whale is a fish. You think, what? Well, you know, why did the court get it wrong? Yes, they didn't get it wrong. The word fish has no objective meaning. Right, words mean whatever meaning is given to them. So in modern English, the word fish exclusively is a scientific meaning. It refers to something that's cold-blooded. So a whale is not a fish because a whale is warm-blooded. But whalers, you know, people who go hunting whales, like in Moby Dick, right, so they use the word fish to refer to anything that swims. And the whalers knew the anatomy of whales as well as anyone. You know, they were cutting them up. They knew exactly the biological differences between whales and fish. But they used the word fish to refer to anything that swims. Now, in the early 19th century, there were lots of whalers around. And whaling was still a big industry because there were still lots of whales left. And so the court decided that is a dominant usage of the word. Right, so the same is true here. In 21st century English, the word bird has very specific meaning. It means something with a beak and feathers that lays eggs. And that's a meaning that's been set by zoology. But the biblical Hebrew word, the word in Tanakh, oath, it doesn't mean that. Right? So a bat, you know, it has no connotations. It doesn't have to mean a beak and feathers and lays eggs. So a bat is an oath, even though a bat is not a bird. So that's a problem you get when you translate words from Hebrew into English, with any translation. Anytime you translate a word, so the language you're translating into, that word, you know, the word is going to have certain meanings, certain connotations that are not present in the original. So you translate oath into bird because there's no better translation. So, you know, you run into this problem because, you know, it's not a bird. But you realize then that the English word bird does not have the same exact same connotations as the Hebrew word oath. All right, so a bat is an oath. So for example, so then if you were doing, you know, a scientific encyclopedia of animals, you'd have mammals, and that would include dogs and cats and bats and whales, and you'd have birds and so on. But if you're approaching it from a Torah perspective, you have chayos. Right, so I have an encyclopedia of chayos. So it's not cows, right, because the cows are mammals, but a cow is not a chaya, right? And it's not a bat, because a bat is a mammal, but a bat is not a chaya. And a chaya means an animal that's on the land. And it's interesting. A couple of years ago, I read in some book by it was a book by a non-Orthodox rabbi, but explaining the Torah. And he said something about kashrus, and he said a whale is not kosher because a whale does not have split hooves or chew the cud. That's not why a whale is not kosher. Why is a whale not kosher? Because it doesn't have fins or scales. And a whale is a treif fish, not a treif chaya. Right? So, you know, it's a different perspective in the animal kingdom. And again, it's not a matter, it's not a conflict between Torah and science. It's just two completely different frameworks for approaching the animal kingdom. So then you get onto a more difficult thing. So what about an ostrich? So, I heard about that. I heard about that. Gotta get a picture of this. Excuse me, try and figure it out.
Make sure you get Louisiana.
Don't break it though, we had already one broken one.
Don't break it.
What did I just miss? The off drain. It's very common. It's shores of North Africa that used to hang off spit checks. Why? I say why?
You can say why the rabbit
does. He has no idea why.
They said that how does an ostrich incubate its eggs? It incubates its eggs by staring at them. And then it's the energy imparted by staring at its eggs that makes the eggs hatch. So it shows you the power of concentration and kavana. So there were shoals, many shoals in North Africa that used to display ostrich eggs in shoals in order to remind people of the power of kavana. That's the first time I've actually seen it. Cool. Back one step. So we said oaf does not mean bird because a bat is an oaf, right? So how do we explain oaf? Something that flies, right? Because a bat flies. Right. So what do you do about an ostrich? Ostrich doesn't fly. So is an ostrich an oaf? Chickens fly. No, they fly. So a lot of the commercial chickens have been bred to be so fat that it's hard for them to do it, but essentially speaking, chickens fly. So ostriches cannot fly. Ostriches cannot fly in the least bit. So is an ostrich an oaf? Penguins don't fly either. So is an ostrich an oaf? So it's not 100% straightforward. I would probably say yes, because in the list of trade birds in the Torah, one of them is the Bassayana. Now, it's not 100% clear what the Bassayana is, but it seems very likely that it's an ostrich. So if the Bassayana is the ostrich, that means the ostrich is here is being presented as an oaf. Right. But an ostrich doesn't fly. So how can an ostrich be an oaf if an oaf is something that flies?
Beak.
So the answer is an oaf is not something that flies. Alright, so what's an oaf? So here again, we run into a problem. This is a problem that comes from translating. So we've said, okay, it's not exactly right to translate oaf as bird, because the English word bird has different meanings than the Hebrew word oaf. But it's more than that. What do people then switch to doing? They switch to searching for another definition of oaf. It'll match a certain set of criteria. But that's also a mistranslation. Not a mistranslation, but a misconceptualization. In modern science, when things are categorized, they have a certain list of criteria, and you have to check off all those criteria to be in that category. Alright, so if you're going to be fit in the category of bird, there's three criteria: bird, feathers, eggs. Right? Whatever it is, there's going to be certain criteria. But who says that the Torah works that way? Doesn't need to work that way. Doesn't need to be a certain single set of criteria that need to be matched by everything in that. That's just us, you know, projecting our modern scientific mindset onto a whole different way of looking at the world. So it could be that oaf in the Torah could be there's different ways as qualifying as oaf. Could be oaf just means something birdish. Right? So, you know, an eagle is birdish because it's got everything, it's got a beak and feathers and lays eggs and flies. A bat is birdish because it has wings and flies. And an ostrich is birdish because it stands on two legs and it has a beak and feathers and lays eggs. And it doesn't need to be that oaf is a single definition. It could be anything that's birdish. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that no, an ostrich is not the Bassayana and an ostrich is not an oaf. That's also a possibility, but I'm more inclined to go with the former. Okay, so that's one example of how, you know, in presenting the animal kingdom, the basic categories could be very different from those that when we're approaching it from a scientific perspective. So next we get on to the end of identifying the animals of the Torah. Okay, we've got to figure out what they are. So some of them is very easy, some of them not so easy. Yep.
By the very definition, the word oaf means, it's the shorish is af, which is flay.
Yes, correct. But it could be that even if the etymology starts off that way, it could then take on anything that's loosely similar. definitely. So identifying animals. Some are easy, some are not so easy. Right? Tzvi. What's a tzvi? Deer. No. Tzvi is not a deer. How do I know? Because the Gemara in Chulin says that the horns of a tzvi are not branched. Right, but the horns of a deer are branched. So, see from there, speak cannot be a deer. So right there on the spot, Rashi says, I don't understand what the Gemara is saying. He says, surely the horns of the hirsch, right, the deer, they are branched. So Rashi says, it must be what we call a tzvi is not what Chazal call a tzvi. Right, so what is a tzvi? So we know it's got horns that are not branched, and it's also described as the most Shirashim, right? Tzvi is always the most beautiful, most graceful creature. What does tzvi mean? Tzvi is also a word that means, you know, splendor, beauty. So tzvi is in fact this animal. Let's get the picture. A bison.
What? I wouldn't call that graceful.
No, bison's not very graceful. Tzvi is a gazelle. There you go. Gazelle. All right, gazelle. Now, nice pictures. Here we go, look at that. Beautiful, beautiful animal. Okay. So, if the tzvi is the gazelle, why does everyone translate tzvi as deer? So, the answer is as follows. If you ever see Israelis come to New York for the first time, right, what do you notice the Israelis are most excited to see in New York? More than the shopping. More than Costco. What? Squirrels. Right. The Israelis go wild with excitement over squirrels. And the Americans are like, what? You know, disgusting vermin? What? And the answer is, Israelis have never seen them. Israelis have never seen squirrels. No wild squirrels in Israel. That happens. Israelis have never seen them. So it's exciting for them. You know, conversely, I speak to Americans about hyraxes and I get these blank looks. Right, whereas every Israeli knows what one is. We'll get to those later. Right, so the point is, different parts of the world have different animals. The animals that you have in America are not the same as the animals that are in Israel. Right, different parts of the world have different animals. Now, the animals mentioned in Tanakh are going to be the animals of Eretz Yisrael. Right, because yes, Hashem knows all the animals in the world, but you're not going to find pandas or penguins or polar bears mentioned in Tanakh. Why? Because Tanakh revolves around the Bnei Israel. It's animals that they encountered. It's animals the Nevi'im draw upon the animal kingdom to teach ideas. It's going to be animals that people are familiar with. Right? So you know, that's why you're not going to find any pandas or penguins or polar bears in Tanakh. So now in Eretz Yisrael, you have deer and you have gazelles. Right? The deer is the ayal, the gazelle is the tzvi. But in Europe, there's no gazelles at all. Gazelles only live in Asia. Europe has no gazelles. Europe has lots of deer, but no gazelles. So in Europe, they transpose the name tzvi from the gazelle to the deer. All right, so that's why you have the Rashi there saying, I don't understand. The Gemara says that the tzvi's horns are not branched, but you know the hirsch's horns are branched. Because in Europe, all they had was deer. All right, so they transferred the name tzvi from the gazelle to the deer. And that's interesting. That's how you get the name. So that's how you get the name tzvi hirsch. Right, Hirsch is German for deer, and that's how you get the name Naphtali Tzvi, the Netziv, right? Naphtali Tzvi. So why do those two names go together, Naphtali and Tzvi? Because of the bracha that Yaakov gave to Naphtali. What's the bracha that Yaakov gave? Naphtali Ayala Shalucha, right? And now it doesn't say Naphtali Tzvi Shalucha. It says Naphtali Ayala Shalucha. So how do you get the name Naphtali Tzvi? Because in Europe they were mixed together. The name Naphtali Tzvi might have started off as Naphtali Hirsch, and then it went back to Naphtali Tzvi, even though it should be Naphtali Ayal. Right, and if you look at a lot of convention contemporary, the Jews in North Africa, they always maintain the Masorah that the Tzvi is the gazelle. And so, but the Jews who went to Europe, right, so in Europe they had no gazelle, so they transferred the name Tzvi to the deer. And you look at a lot of English translations of the Chumash. So in the Chumash, the Tzvi and the Ayal are often mentioned together in Sefer VaYikra. So when you look at these English translations, and it will say Tzvi, it will translate as deer, and then in the next word in the Pasuk is Ayal. So then you can kind of sense that the translator got a bit stuck because he's only used the word deer. Right, so you see he's looking for another word, so he'll say a hind. But a hind is just a doe, a deer, a female deer, right? It's just another name, it's just a female variety of a deer. Really, the tzvi and the ayal are two different animals. But people writing in English, coming from America, they just don't have the vocabulary. Yeah. A hart is a male deer. Right? But the tzvi and the ayal, you see in the Torah and Parshas with A, especially you see clearly, it's two different types of animals. Right? So, So what happened, it was in Europe, people transposed the identity. Nesher, what's the Nesher? Ayal is a deer. Deer is the one with the big branched antlers. King of birds, the Nesher. What's the Nesher? Eagle. No. How do I know? Because there are psukim in Tanakh that describe the Nesher as being bald. Are eagles bald?
Bald eagle.
Lovely head of hair. Wish I had as much hair as a bald eagle. Bald eagles were originally called baldy-headed eagles. Baldy is an Old English word meaning white. They were white-headed eagles. Right, but they're not bald. Plus, the Nesher is described in Tanakh as feeding on carrion. Right, dead animals. Eagles usually take live prey. So which bird is bald and feeds on carrion?
Vulture.
The vulture. Right, griffin vulture, largest, most magnificent bird of prey in Eretz Yisrael, like a 9-foot wingspan. It's also, it's the lord of the air. It's the highest flying bird. You look in the Guinness Book of Records, you'll see the altitude record for a bird is held by a griffin vulture, which collided with an airplane at 37,000 feet. Right. So, if the Nesher is really the vulture, why, when you look at English translations, why is it always translated as eagle?
I thought the condor was the highest flying.
No, griffin vulture is the highest flying. Condor is basically the American equivalent of the vulture. It would probably also be...
Condors live on carrion?
Condors
live on the South America?
I don't think so.
Yeah, Andean condor, yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to the Californian one.
Endangered, right? It's one of the famous endangered birds in America. Right? It's like the California condor, the spotted owl, and the bald eagle. See, there's a story about the guy who was arrested. He actually shot and killed and cooked and ate a California condor. So on his trial, he didn't know it was in danger. The first time he'd ever been hunting or shooting, never done anything like it before, so he got let off. And as he was leaving the court, the judge said to him, "I'm just curious, what did California condor taste like?" He said, "Well, kind of like a cross between spotted owl and bald eagle." So Nesher is really the vulture. So if Nesher is really the vulture, why is it always translated as eagle? Same thing. But in Europe, there aren't any vultures, but there's a lot of big, prominent eagles. In Europe, it's the eagle that's the king of birds. About 12 years ago, I was working as a consultant for Art Scroll for Chulin, for the translation of Chulin. So when I contributed this material about the Nesher, so the editor called me up, he was very upset. Oh, can't be Nesher, you know, vulture, you know, disgusting bird. So this is all cultural. Right, in America, the vulture is considered a disgusting bird. Right. Why? It probably has to do with, I know, Disney's The Jungle Book. Also, the only vultures you have here are turkey vultures. Right? Whereas in America, the condor is considered to be something magnificent, something spectacular. It's not what? Right. The Nesher is not the Adler. Right. So in America, culturally, the vulture is disgusting and the condor's spectacular. Right, in the Middle East, not just the Jews, but other nations too, it's the vulture that's considered the king of birds. It's the largest, most spectacular, you know, highest flying bird of prey. It's the lord of the air. Just like the condor is viewed in America, that's how the vulture is viewed in Israel. Okay, so a lot of these things are also, you know, conceptual. So actually interesting. So in this book, in the encyclopedia, so in the section on lions, so I was quoting the Gemara that speaks about the Midrash and speaks about how the king of Chaios is the Aryeh and the king of Ophos is the Nesher. So there I translated Nesher as eagle. So why did I translate Nesher as eagle if Nesher is really the vulture? Because if I was writing about the identity of the Nesher, so I'd write that, then it's a vulture. But here it's a Midrash that's speaking about which is the king of different classes, right? And I'm writing here for an English audience. So, you know, the conceptual translation of the king of birds in American terminology is the eagle. Right? Because there we're talking about the conceptual idea, the king of birds. So conceptually, in America, which is, you know, the audience of this book, right, the English-speaking world, so conceptually, an English-speaking country, is the king of birds is the eagle. So that's the conceptual translation of Nesher, even though it's not the accurate translation from a species identity standpoint.
It's just plain wrong.
It's not wrong.
It is wrong.
It's not.
But he wanted it to sound good, so you said the word eagle. That's what it sounds like.
No. No, I had a footnote explaining, and I had a footnote explaining that really technically speaking is the Nesher, but
that's good.
You're translating it into the... This is a conceptual statement. No, I'm trying to make it palatable. I wasn't going to make it palatable. Believe me, I don't care about palatable. It's the appropriate conceptual translation, because there we're talking about the king, like the king of birds.
Which is the Nesher.
Lizzie.
I never
Lizzie. Okay, so that's a point. It can be argued. It can definitely be argued. Okay, another example. An example that's offered, that's taken up a disproportionate amount of my time in the last 15 years. The Shafan. The Shafan. Right, so mentioned a few places in Tanakh, Parshas Shemini, Parshas Re'eh, Tehillim, Mishlei, Adam HaShchodesh, we say Baruch Hinafshi, it speaks about Shafanim, Ha'arim, Ha'gavohim, La'ye'elim, Salayim, Ha'asal, Shafanim. So what's a Shafan? So in Ivrit, in Israel, there's a popular kids' nursery rhyme, Ha'Shafan, Ha'Katan, right, and Shafan is a rabbit. Shafan is a rabbit. However, is that the correct translation in Tanakh? So the answer is it can't be. Two reasons why. Let's think about this. So first of all, we have this pasuk in Tehillim, Salatim Machzel Shafanim. The Shafan is something that hides in rocks. And also in Mishlei, it speaks about how there are some animals that are small, but they're strategic. And it says that the Shafanim are not very strong, but they hide in rocks. That's their strategy to avoid being eaten. But rabbits don't hide in rocks. Where do rabbits hide?
Burrows.
Rabbits hide in burrows, so that can't be what the pasuk is talking about. Plus, there's no rabbits in Eretz Yisrael. No rabbits at all. So what's a Shafan? So we have this, so really the pasuk in Tehillim gives it away. It says, Ha'arim ha'gavohim la'ya'elim, right? The high hills are for the ya'elim. What's a ya'el? A wild goat, an ibex. Right, Salatim ma'asal ha'shafanim. So that pasuk tells us two things about the Shafan. What are the two things we see about the Shafan in that pasuk? Okay, three things, I guess. Okay, small creature, hides in rocks, and what's the other thing we see about the Shafan in that pasuk? Right, there's an association with Ya'elim, because it appears in the same pasuk. Now, for those of you who've been to Eretz Yisrael, where in Eretz Yisrael do you go to see Ya'elim?
Ein Gedi.
Ein Gedi. Ein Gedi is the famous place to see them. Ein Gedi is named after them, right? Ein is a spring, Gedi is a goat. Right, it says in Tanakh, David HaMelech, he was hiding with the Ya'elim in Ein Gedi. Right, that's like the famous place. You go to Ein Gedi, you see the Ya'elim on the Ha'arim HaGavohim, and in the rocks, it's a very rocky place, you see little furry animals hiding. Right, so that is clearly the Shafan. What are these little furry animals? So in English it's called a hyrax, and it kind of looks like a groundhog, but they're anatomically very, very different. And I'll show you a picture of one. Yeah, let's find a picture of the Shafan.
There's nothing
here
else
we go.
There besides.
Here's a hyrax. Here's a hyrax, and here we go. There's a picture of them hiding in rocks, right? And in fact, hyraxes, they only have, it's called, its full name in English is the rock hyrax. They only live in places where there's rocks for them to hide in. That is, fundamentally, the whole lifestyle is based around rocks. Right, so even in the Bronx Zoo, actually, in the Bronx Zoo, they have the ibex and the hyrax in the same enclosure. Right, these are two animals that are very closely associated. So if Shafan is really this weird animal called the hyrax, that's an example, by the way, of how, you know, Shafan is something that everyone in Israel is familiar with. You see them in Ein Gedi now, you see them everywhere. But Americans have never heard of it. It's just not a familiar animal in this part of the world. You look at English translations of Shafans, you'll get all kinds of weird things in English translations. You'll see Coney, Rock Badger, right, all kinds of things. So if the Shafan is really the hyrax, why in Ivrit is Shafan a rabbit? Same as before. In Europe, there are no hyraxes, but in Europe, you have rabbits. Right, in fact, the rabbits originate from Spain. And Spain was discovered by the Phoenicians, who used to live in the Middle East. And when the Phoenicians came to Spain, they saw these little furry animals hopping around, which reminded them of the hyraxes. So they gave a name to this country, they called it Shafania. Right, so that's how Spain got its name. Right, so people won't move to Europe, just like they transposed the Tzvi from the gazelle to the deer, and the Nesher from the vulture to the eagle, they transposed Shafan from the hyrax of the rabbit, and it got stuck to it. The name got stuck to it. So even, you know, when they came back to Eretz Yisrael, and the Hebrew started to be resurrected as a spoken language, the name Shafan had gotten stuck to the rabbit. So now in Ivrit, a hyrax is called a Shafan Sela, a rock rabbit, to differentiate it from the regular rabbit. And last year I saw an article on the Times of Israel website. It said how the police in Israel had arrested somebody for growing marijuana. And in his defense, he said he was growing it to feed to his hyrax. I guess he wanted it to be a hyrax, I don't know. So I was reading this article, and I was like, no way. There is no way this guy has a pet hyrax. I have hyraxes. I have a special license from the Israel Nature Reserves Authority. It's certainly not an easy animal to keep in captivity. And there is no way, there's no way this guy is a hyrax. So I looked into it. What happened? At the Times of Israel, they translate their article, all of their articles from the Ivrit articles. And the original Ivrit article was about when the police arrested the guy, he said he was growing the marijuana for his shafan. Right, so he was speaking Ivrit, right, with shafan referring to a rabbit. But whoever translated it, he'd used the Tanakh translation of shafan. So they'd come up with a story that he was growing the marijuana to feed to his hyrax. It's actually very cute. This year, I got this kid's book. Children's book, Ivrit children's book about this rabbit who has an identity crisis because he's being called a shafan, but he's really an arneves, and he goes to this group therapy session, and there's a nesher sitting there, you know, there's an eagle, a vulture sitting there, and a gazelle sitting there, all these animals with their, you know, identity crisis. So what's going on with all these misidentities? So it also with the, you know, geographical variation. Again, you look at the Shmona Shratzin. So in the museum, we have our Shmona Shratzim exhibit, and it's a two-tiered exhibit. We have two rows of eight cages, and some of the cages have multiple species in them, because they have all different identities given for the Shmona Shratzim. So how do you have all these different identities given? So it depends, everyone translates it into the animal in their part of the world. Right? So that's why you see, like, with Sadi Gon and Rashi having very different views on the Shmona Shratzim, because Rashi was in France, and Sadi Gon was in Egypt, and Eretz Yisrael. So really we see that, you know, part of, you know, identifying animals in the Torah is recognizing that they're not going to be the same as the animals that you're familiar with from America or Europe. Everyone approaches the animal kingdom in terms of what they're familiar with. Right? There's a lot of weird, in Bet Shemesh where I live, so there's a lot of weird, long, furry animals running around. People think they're ferrets, people think they're weasels, and they're not, they're mongooses. Right, but Americans are not familiar with mongooses. Everyone approaches the animal kingdom in terms of what they're familiar with, but now the problem, that's the problem of Golos, right? After the Churban, it's not only the Beis Hamikdash and the sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael we lost, it's familiarity with the whole natural world that the Torah drew from. And an example, you see, you might think, okay, so why does it matter? So partly is understanding the Torah. That's important to know what the words refer to. Another thing is understanding the messages. Like you have the Mishnah Kal Kanesher. Right, Yehuda ben Tema says he should be Kal Kanesher. Now, what does that mean? They're very heavy birds. Right? Eagles and vultures, too, they're tremendously heavy. Right, I did a video session. I was recording, I'm trying to work on a documentary, so I was doing the session with a big eagle I was holding in my arm. And it was the next day, I couldn't lift up my arm. And I found out that the people who go hunting with eagles, they have a special brace to hold their arm up. Because it's so hard to hold up this heavy bird. So why would you say Kal Kanesher if it's if you say Kal Kanesher, you pick a hummingbird, right? You don't pick the heaviest bird. So and a vulture is probably even heavier than an eagle. So what's going on? But if you understand vultures, you understand that it has to do with how they fly. And most birds, when they fly, it's very laborious, beating their wings, right? But vultures, what they do is they soar. They have these enormous, very broad wings, and they catch the thermal. They're living in hot countries where you have thermals rising up from the rocks. And they soar up in the thermals, and they fly higher than any other bird. Why do they fly so high? Because they're carrion eaters, and they want to see where the carrion is and where there's other birds circling down on the carcasses. So when you realize that Kal Kanesher doesn't mean, it's not the physical weight of the bird, it's how lightly it soars up. And the idea is that just as the vulture soars up effortlessly, so too when we're getting up to serve Hashem, it should be effortlessly. When we're getting out of, we're going to do a mitzvah, it shouldn't be with a moan and a groan and a kvetch. It should be, you know, a spring in our step. You're going to help somebody, it's not with a groan. Sure, pleasure, no problem. It's Kal Kanesher.
Usually is speed. Well,
but it's not in that Mishnah because you have Rotz Katzvi. So Rotz is speed. Right, so in order to understand Kalkan Esher, you have to know what an Esher is and what an Esher does. Right? And if you're you know, if you're not familiar with the animal world of the Torah, you're gonna start off with the eagle. Nesher is an eagle, and what does it mean? Or Kalkan Esher. Right? So that's another reason why it's important to understand what the animals of the Torah are. What time am I supposed to finish? Keep going. Believe me, I could talk for 2 weeks straight. Let's move on to a different topic here, though. So let's move on to animal symbolism, right? So why are these animals all being mentioned in Tanakh and Chazal? So occasionally it's because they were involved in events, right? Bilam and the donkey. Occasionally it's for halachas, right? The kashrus is the kashrus. But the majority of time, animals are mentioned, it's for symbolic ideas, right? To teach concepts, and in Chazal too, like we just mentioned with the Nesher. And he'll start with the lion. Right? The Mishnah says what? Gibor Ka'ari should be as strong as a lion. So what does that mean? So simply speaking, it's because lions are very strong animals. Right? A lion weighs up to 500 pounds, right? A massively powerful animal. But what's the idea that we should be as strong as a lion? Lift weights, build muscles. So I want to suggest, although a different insight into this Mishnah. What's the technical term for a group of lions?
Pride.
Pride, right. What's the technical term for a group of tigers? A disaster. A bloodbath. You can't have a group of tigers. They'll tear each other to pieces. See, big cats are carnivores. It means they're aggressive by nature. Right, so it means it's hard for them to get along with each other because they're aggressive, right? So tigers, cheetahs, leopards, lynxes, cougars, right? They all live alone. Of all the big cats, it's only the lion that's somehow able to control its aggression and live in groups. Right, so Ezehu Gibor, who is powerful, Akovish is Yitzroi, the one that controls his inclination. Right, so that's a whole new insight in the power of the lion. It's not its raw physical strength, it's the ability to overcome that in the presence of other lions. But it's not very small. It's not the same big group structure as lions. Another aspect. Let's go on to another interesting aspect. Kashrus, okay? So kashrus, you have different groups, right? You have chayas and behemoths, right? It has to be matris pasa, maligera. You have birds, you have fish, and you have insects. Right? And which insects are kosher? Locusts, right? And so, first of all, what's the idea behind that? So we don't know. Right? But ultimately, kashrus is a chuk. We don't really know the idea behind it. But a certain we search for insights whenever we can. And a certain insight into this is that when you have locusts? Locusts are grasshoppers that swarm in plagues. And when you have a plague of locusts, it's not like cicadas that you have in America. So you have a plague of cicadas, so it's annoying. It's a pain. When you have a plague of locusts, we're talking billions. We're talking like the sky goes black. 100 years ago, there was a plague of locusts in Israel. And you should see the photos. They just destroy everything. They'll eat the clothing off your back. Right, so you have massive famine. So what's the... But if you can eat the locusts, right, then there's something left to eat. And they're very healthy. Very healthy food item. New Yorker last year had a whole article about how, for environmental reasons, we've got to move into bug farming. Right, and insects are a very good source of protein, much healthier than all this stuff. Right, so,
very poor North African countries.
Sure, absolutely. Now you don't have so many locust plagues because before the locusts swarm, they metamorphosize through different stages. Before the stage where they're flying and swarming, they all gather on the ground in one place. And usually now you can identify where that place is and they spray them from the air. So a couple of years ago, there was a locust plague in Egypt. So I drove down to the border. I got up at 4 a.m. because when they're flying around, it's hard to catch them. And just in the morning when they're cold, that's when they go flying, you can catch them. It was a funny story. I was driving around with a friend, we're looking for the locusts. Suddenly realize the bush is just one huge mass of locusts. So we start driving towards it, and I got out of the car, and suddenly I hear this voice saying, "Get back in the car!" I'm like, "Who is that?" It was a Ministry of Agriculture van, jeep, and they said, "You got to get back in the car. We're fumigating the area." So I said, okay, I'll go back in the car. So I go back to the car, and they turn around to drive off, and they drive off. Of course, I'm back, and I was running towards the bush to get some locusts. Then I hear this noise, it sounded like a billion beating wings, but I looked up, and it was just a rise. It was a plane coming over the horizon. It's about 100 feet away, spraying a pesticide. And at that point, I also heard a voice screaming again, "Get back in the car!" It was an agriculture jeep that had turned around to make sure what we were doing. So I ran to the bushes, just grabbed a double handful of locusts, and ran back into the car. So I took the locusts back home, crunchy on the outside in the chewy centre. My wife doesn't eat them, she's locust intolerant. The question is, how can I eat them?
I thought by Marcus
No, it just says no plague to the extent of the one that there was. Not that there weren't locusts at all. No. So what's the deal with locusts, right? So the Torah says that certain locusts are kosher, right? But you have to go have a Masorah, right? And who has the Masorah? The Moroccans, the Yemenites, the Algerians, all the Jews from North Africa, they all have a Masorah, that it's this, the Egyptian desert locust. That's what it's called, Cystocercia gregaria. Now, this might come as a shock, but I'm actually not North African. So, I know, I look it, don't I? So how could I rely on the Masorah? So the poskim that I consulted said as follows. It's not like with, say, kitnius. So with kitnius, milling Ashkenaz is not to eat kitnius. So we have a milling, not to eat kitnius. So then we can't go and adopt someone. You can't then go and adopt some Sephardi milling to eat kitnius, because we have Amasor is against that. But with locusts, and this gets back to the point we were discussing earlier, there's no Ashkenazi minhag or masorah to not eat locusts. There's just an absence of an Ashkenazi masorah to eat locusts. Why? Because there are no locusts in Ashkenaz. All right, so you have the mafashim and the Shulchan Aruch who say that now we in Ashkenaz, we have no masorah to eat locusts. So there's the people who take that as a positive masorah in Ashkenaz, they're against eating locusts. But it's not. It's not like they had locusts in Ashkenaz, but the minhag was not to eat them. But just weren't any locusts around. Right, so in the absence of any Masorah either way, so the person I consulted said it's fine to adopt the view of those who do have the Masorah. Right, so that's how I was able to eat locusts. So I must say it was very hard culturally, to get over the idea of eating a bug. I wouldn't do it again. Just had one.
Did you bring some?
No, I didn't bring any. Extremely illegal to bring him into America. Okay, one final area. So we're talking about interactions with animals. Can you kill animals? Can you eat animals? Can you hunt animals? Can you make fur coats out of animals? Can you make fur coats out of animals? I don't know, is this safe? I just came from the Five Towns. I don't know, what's it like here though? Is it safe? I'm talking about that topic. So, to be honest, I've not seen any Sfarim discuss it. Except one. Theoretically, the idea is that you're allowed to kill an animal for a legitimate purpose. Right, so for example, for food, right, for medical experimentation, that's a legitimate purpose. Hunting for sport, right, frowned upon in the post-game, because that's not considered to be a legitimate purpose. Keeping warm, that's a legitimate human purpose. On the other hand, the one safer that I saw discuss it said that many people are not doing it to keep warm, they're wearing fur coats in order to show off. Right. So he said vanity would not justify killing an animal. But the situation of fur coats might be slightly different, because you're not actually... Huh?
Not the high strata.
Yeah. You're not killing the animal, you're buying what's ready to be killed, might be different. So let's go on to strimals. Okay, strimals. So this one safer that discusses it said that you shouldn't kill an animal to wear its fur for cover. But I was talking about personal covers. Strimals are not worn for personal cover, theory. Among the Hasidic groups that wear strimals, that is the... They're worn on Shabbos, that's the way you're on a Shabbos. It's covered for Shabbos. That's the uniform, not for personal covered. So that would be okay. But the only issue would be how the animal is killed. When you're killing an animal not to eat, do you have to shecht it? No, you don't. You don't have to shecht it. But you still have an obligation to kill it in a painless manner, painless method. So the question is, how are animals being killed for the fur industry? So I'm not clear. It seems that sometimes they are killed in relatively painless ways, other times not so painless. So that would be something which would require exploring. So I'll just leave off with the story. Strimals are made from sable. Right? Sable is like a mink. Right? due to the sables, you know, so the Steinwald's made from the fur skins of a sable, which is an issue for the sables, definitely, because the sables need their fur coats to keep their insides in. So, the story of the two sables who were being caught by trappers, as they're being hauled off into their respective cars, one sable calls out to the other one, he says, "Frank, I'll see you in shore." Okay, any questions? Oh, and I should mention that I have my books available here, the Tower Encyclopedia of the Animal Kingdom, which I have on sale at $40, $10 less than the list price. I also have the Challenge of Creation, which discusses dinosaurs and antiquity of the universe, science and Torah issues, and Sacred Monsters, which discusses the more strange animals discussed in the Gemara, like unicorns and dragons and mermaids and spontaneous generation, conflicts between science and Chazal. And those books are $30 each. I encourage, those books are $30 each, this is $40. I encourage you, if you come to Israel, to come visit the Biblical Museum of Natural History, where we have a display, a combination of live animals and taxidermy animals, or the animals of Tanakh. It's a guided tour. You have to reserve in advance. You can't just show up. You have to reserve in advance.
Where is it?
Bet Shemesh? Yes, thank you very much.